17. In the highest part of the High Hab, far above the sprawling lights of Crabtree, Svetlana sat in numbed silence. It was near the end of the 12th year of settlement. The analysis team had just processed the latest data on the Doppler measurements, and the numbers were not remotely what she had been hoping for. "This can't be right," she said, shaking the aged Flexi like a damp dish rag. "We're fewer than 8 weeks from Spiker. We damn well should be seeing some slowdown by now." "Well, we're not," Nick Thale said. He sat opposite her, his hands laced as if in prim contemplation. It was months since their last face-to-face meeting, and Thale looked older than she remembered. He had allowed his hair to grow out around his bald crown, falling in snow-white waves that lent him the faintly simian look of an emeritus professor. He was accompanied by Denise Nadis, her dreadlocks now shot through with grey, her dark skin age spotted around the cheeks, the lines around her mouth deeper than Svetlana recalled. Unconsciously, Svetlana touched her own face and felt alien textures that had not been there a year or so ago. They were all getting old, even in the time-dilated reference frame of Janus. "Can I trust these numbers?" she asked. "We're having trouble making measurements on the blue-shifted face," Thale said. "It's difficult enough getting our equipment to function against those fluxes. Symbolist sabotage isn't helping matters either."
"What sabotage?" Svetlana asked.
"Frida Walensky's extremists. Ever since Gregor died," Thale shrugged, knowing that no more needed to be said.
"They don't like us making measurements into the blue," Nadis said, "especially after what happened to Bob Unglis."
Robert Unglis had left a suicide note and driven a tractor over the horizon from Crabtree in the direction of the bow face. His last coherent transmissions had spoken of brightness, and the luminous, beckoning things he saw in that brightness, even as the blue shifted radiation chewed away his mind. After that, he spoke only in riddles. The symbolists claimed that Unglis had received divine information, that his every fevered utterance must be scrutinized for revelatory content.
"They think it's a kind of blasphemy," Nadis went on. "They send out robots from the Maw to cut our data lines and smash our instruments. They deny it, of course."
"We should have locked them up years ago," Svetlana said.
Parry grimaced. "We've been over this. We need someone in the Maw to grease the clockwork, and it might as well be symbolists. At least they're dedicated to their work." Svetlana gritted her teeth and moved on.
"Tell me about the data."
Nadis shifted uncomfortably.
"The numbers are reliable. Within the stated margin of error, there's been no significant change in the frequency of the starlight. Either something freaky is happening to the space-time ahead of us, or we're not slowing down."
At 5 G's of effective acceleration, Janus had taken 2 months to reach its present cruise velocity following its departure from Earth's solar system. Svetlana's best mind still had no idea how the moon had accelerated itself, but they had assumed that the same mechanism would operate in reverse during the anticipated slowdown phase. But they were already into that crucial 2-month window, and there was no hint that the moon had begun its deceleration procedure. They were still shooting through space at a hair's breadth below the speed of light.
"If we're not slowing down," Svetlana said, "what the hell is going to happen to us when we reach Spiker?"
"I guess that's up to Janus and the Spikans," Thale said.
Parry coughed warningly.
"If you could err towards keeping your remarks constructive, Nick, that would be great." Thale looked nonplussed. "Then I have nothing useful to add. You've seen the latest imagery. The Spiker structure is still ahead of us, and it's turned its long axis around to align with our present vector. Whether we slow down or not, we're going to enter that tube."
"And then what?" Svetlana said. "Do we just shoot on through like a rat through a pipe?"
"I've no idea. You might as well cast tea leaves."
Nadis leaned forward, clicking her purple fingernails against the table. "Maybe the slowdown mechanism is different."
"Go on," Svetlana said, with a strained smile of encouragement. "Janus was alone in our solar system. It only had its own motive power to accelerate up to cruise speed. Up ahead, it might be different. Maybe the Spiker structure is part of the deceleration system."
Svetlana flashed her attention to Thale.
"Any thoughts on that, Nick?"
"It's as good a guess as any," he said.
"What about the spikes?" Parry asked. Any idea where they fit into all this? None whatsoever, Thale said simply.
It can't be coincidence, though, Parry persisted.
2 months from slowdown and these things start pushing their way through the ice. There's got to be a connection, right? While she waited for Nick Thale to favour them all with a reply, Svetlana studied the latest map of the Spire growth. Since the discovery of the first breakthrough point, 19 similar features had been mapped around Janus, spaced more or less equidistantly. Enormous spire-like structures were pushing their way through the crust, ramming past machinery and ice, squeezing obstructions aside like erupting wisdom teeth. The spires glittered with symbols in new syntactical patterns that confounded the best theories of the linguists. They rose higher and higher, until they were 1 kilometer thick at the base, and their needled tips were 20 kilometers from the surface of Janus. 2 of the spires were visible from Crabtree, thrusting up through the sternward ice cap. Where there had been darkness, now there were tilted wedges of pastel light slanting from the horizon like frozen aurorae. Their sides were veined with lava lines, snaking in meandering trajectories to a point just below the spire, where they plunged inside. Around the clock, transits raced up the spires, laden with freight. Unguessable transformations must have been taking place inside them.
Nick, she pressed.
You want guesswork, I'll give you guesswork, but don't blame me for it later.
I won't.
More than likely there is a connection. Janus seems to be preparing itself for something. It might be the slowdown we've all been expecting. Maybe these spikes are part of the mechanism, and they're going to bring us to a dead stop on a dime as soon as we hit the tube. Or maybe it's nothing like that at all.
I need something, Svetlana said desperately.
We'll know sooner or later, Thale said, shrugging resignedly. Svetlana thought about the skeletal tube they were approaching, with its struts and spars, its almost unimaginably expansive internal surface area, 1 million Earth-sized planetary surfaces at the very least, each of which might easily contain several billion sentient creatures if the Spiken's idea of tolerable population density was anything like humanity's. Then again, there might be no Spikens waiting at all, just their ancient and obedient machines. Perhaps it would be very difficult to tell the difference from a human perspective. She felt a bleak, premonitionary chill shiver through her. She thanked Thale and Nadis and dismissed them. She moved to the window and hugged herself against the stellar cold that seemed to push infiltrating fingers through the glass. The distant spikes twinkled with ominous activity. Parry waited, saying nothing, leaving her with her thoughts.
I'm scared, she said at last, as if she had the room to herself. I'm scared and I worry that we might be terribly wrong about all this.
She heard his footsteps, saw his dim reflection loom behind her in the glass. Parry wrapped his arms around and held her tight, and though she was glad of that, nothing he did could take away the chill and the fear.
It's good of you to keep me informed, Craig Schrope said, even if it isn't the best news.
They were in the High Hab, in one of the administrative chambers of the Interim Authority. Schrope had an office to himself, lined with wangwood shelves, brimming with hard copy. He spent most of his days there, occupying himself with the legal processes of the judicial apparatus. It was solitary work, for the most part, but that suited Schrope. Despite years of rehabilitation, his emotional constitution was still fragile, and there were only a handful of people in whose company he felt truly at ease. Svetlana felt an elitist thrill at being counted amongst that number. They would probably never be close friends, but simply being on civil terms was an astonishing improvement on the old state of affairs.
I wanted you to know that we aren't keeping anything from you, Svetlana said. You'll hear rumors, I'm sure, but the truth is that we haven't got a clue what it is.
Do you have a name for it yet?
The Iron Sky, she said tersely.
Shortly after attaining their final height of 20 kilometers, the spires had changed again. Their upper extremities, the last 3 kilometers, had thickened into bud-like forms that had then split open along invisible seams, each of them forming 6 radial petals defined by faint tracings of lava. The petals reached out 3 kilometers from the central bud, oblivious to Janus's gravitational field. Then the petals had started growing, spreading and widening like oil slicks. Over the next 2 months they had blocked off more and more of the sky, until their edges met and fused, and then there was no sky except this oppressive black ceiling, suspended 20 kilometers above the ice. The lava lines had faded. Though the spires continued to be lit by spike and symbols, the ceiling was now as dark as the interstellar space it served to hide. "Can you see through it?" Schrope asked, closing one of his legal binders. The paper was thick and vat-grown, the cover appropriated from an old Lockheed Krennicher Fusion Systems spiral-bound technical manual, entitled Tokamak Startup Procedures in a Nutshell.
"Did you hear that we could?"
"Just rumors, Sveta."
"No, we've seen nothing. Everything we shine at it gets absorbed. If there's something on the other side, we're not picking up the echo."
"And the free flyers?"
"Deadsville. If they're still out there, we're not hearing anything from them."
"Does it trouble you?"
"Of course it troubles me. How did you expect it would make me feel?"
"It makes remarkably little difference to me," Schrope said easily. "Down here, entire days go by without me seeing a hint of the outside world. Legal work eats time like a machine, you know."
He put the folder aside. Literally and metaphorically, he had been closing the file on Meredith Bagley. Every now and then, rumors had resurfaced that there had been more to her death than just a grisly accident during routine centrifuge maintenance. Svetlana's anger at the merest hint that she might have tacitly sanctioned it had spurred her to authorize the inquest Schrope had helmed. He was good with legal inquiry. It utilized the same forensic instinct that had worked so well for him in Shalbatana. Terrier Boy's conclusion was that there had been nothing suspicious about the death. The rumors might continue, but there was nothing the judicial apparatus could do about that.
"Your work is important," Svetlana said, "but I have to take the wider view. What's the point of having judicial apparatus if we don't have a world left to govern?"
"Things aren't that bad," Schrope said soothingly. "It's just a sky."
"It won't let us touch it," she said. "We send free flyers up to it and it repels them.
It probably has our best interests at heart." One hand clicked the mechanism of a ballpoint pen, neurotically fast.
"Wouldn't you say?"
"I find it claustrophobic," she said. "I used to swim. I was a pretty good free diver. Water never bothered me, no matter how deep and black and cold. But I always hated having anything above me but sea and clear blue sky."
"It's no worse than what we had before."
"It's been a while since there were stars up there, Svetlana."
"But we could always leave if we wanted to."
He put the folder back onto one of the shelves, squeezing it into place between two other bulging documents. For a colony of under 200 people, Crabtree and its peripheral suburbs generated a considerable amount of legal business. That wasn't too surprising, though. They'd had to build an entire economy from scratch, just so that people could be paid for an honest day's work. After 12 years, the High Hab was still processing complaints from people who felt they had been short-changed in the initial allocation of credits. There was even a black market economy of sorts. Officially, there was no coffee left anywhere on Janus, but if you knew the right people, it was still possible to obtain hitherto unallocated rations.
"It would have killed us to leave," Schrope said, "to drop out of the slipstream, out of the protective shadow of Janus. We'd have lasted about 5 minutes.
But it was an option. I'd always rather have the option, wouldn't you?
Judging by the business that comes through here, Svetlana, most people are just getting on with life." Schrope indicated one of his shelves. "That file on the end is a disputed paternity case. On Earth, we'd have settled it in a few minutes with a DNA profile. It wouldn't even have reached court. Out here, we don't have DNA sequences. Axford's doing the best he can, but he's already a busy man, and I don't wish to take up more of his time than is absolutely necessary. That's just one file. We have divorce proceedings, personal injury claims, accusations of libel. Even the symbolists are claiming religious discrimination."
"They invented their religion from scratch," Svetlana said indignantly. "I've got every damned right to discriminate against them.
Yet by all accounts they do a reasonable job of running things in the moor." She conceded his point with a pout of displeasure.
"Maybe. But how long can we rely on them? They're already saying I've been heavy-handed. I'm not even allowed in the moor now. I have to send Perry."
"All I'm saying is, life goes on. Perhaps the iron sky isn't as bad as you fear."
"That's what people keep telling me.
that Janus is still supplying us with power and materials, that the ice cap is still there, that if we've survived for 12 years, we can survive a bit longer.
Shrope stopped clicking the pen and put it down. You don't sound convinced. I don't like it, Craig. I don't like not knowing what's out there. We should have arrived at the Spiken structure by now.
Maybe we have, he said soothingly, as if the matter was of only passing concern to him. The binary consists of blue stars, Svetlana, hot and very bright. Not a healthy environment for humans. Perhaps the whole point of the sky is to keep us safe from harm.
I hope so, she said. I'm just scared of what we might see on the other side, if we ever get the chance to find out.
He sighed and rocked back in his seat, fingers meshed behind his head. You've been good to me, Svetlana. You called me back from that place I was in, and gave me a chance to make something of myself again. She nodded, but said nothing. Shrope still credited her with doing far more during his years of withdrawal than she knew to be true. Once he had even told her how he had seen Bella, and how she had spoken to him. Svetlana knew for certain then that his memory of that time could not be trusted. I hope I've served Crabtree in some small way, he continued, but I know I'm not indispensable. I know that there are a dozen people who could do this legal dog work just as well as I can.
I don't know, she began.
He shook his head and interrupted her. But one day I hope I can be indispensable, not by shuffling papers, but by doing something concrete, something no one else will do.
I don't follow, she said.
You're scared, and I don't blame you for that. But I've been to a place in my head worse than anything this universe has to offer. If they come, Svetlana, I'll go to meet them. You can send me first. I don't have anything to fear from the Spikens.
Craig,
I'm asking you to let me be your envoy. It's the least I can do.